Good afternoon, everyone. Please take your seats if you can. Welcome to Astronomy. Honey, check out the new neighbors. My name is Bill Rigler. I'm the Senior Manager for Public Relations at Ball Aerospace, located here in Boulder, Colorado. And very delighted to welcome our two guests, Garrett Verschuer and Seth Shostak. And if you've not already, I would strongly encourage that you read their bios in the CWA packet. They are among the most entertaining you'll ever read. Without any further ado, I'd like to ask Garrett to start his remarks. In the meantime, if you've not already, please make sure that you've downloaded the Conference on World Affairs app off of your smartphone or your device. In this session, we'll be utilizing both the CW app as well as note cards that my friend Bruce is holding back in the center aisle in order to receive questions from the audience. Now, to ask questions, and you can do this in real time, simply select the session in the schedule, which is panel 3504, tap live Q&A, and then insert your question. And again, you may also raise your hands at any time to request a note card that we will then read. If you are a student, and we want to make sure that students have priority here, please indicate in your message that you're a student so we know to prioritize you. And finally, because we want to ensure that it's not just me reading the questions and we want to create some connections here, if your question is asked, please stand up so we can identify who you are. Welcome, and buckle in. This is going to be a fun ride. Garrett?
Thank you very much. For me, this is the closing of a couple of circles. I used to be on the board of the Conference of World Affairs about 40 years ago. And when I left the University of Colorado, it was one of my bucket list things to come back as a speaker, so here I am. The other concerns my personal adventures in the search for extraterrestrials. It began here on the Hill, and I'm going to give you a few of the highlights, but if you want to know the full story, it's in this book, and I have two copies for sale here. I was one of the pioneers in the search for extraterrestrials using radio telescopes. This is a fact that is edited out by the SETI Institute, but I happen to have published a paper with Carl Sagan's connivance. And when I came to Boulder, I talked about it, and then word got around that I was interested in this topic. And one day, I met the president of Celestial Seasonings, who had heard of this as well, and he had something called the Urantia book, which he gave me a copy of and tried to convince me that this was the final word, and this was communicated to humans by extraterrestrials. Well, I treated that with the scorn that it deserved. But then, a few days later, I was in the bookstore on the Hill here, and the bookstore manager said, there's a book you should read if you're interested in extraterrestrials. It's written by John Lilly, and it's called The Center of the Cyclone. So I went out and bought it immediately. I bought it right on the spot, actually. And I read, John Lilly was the one who did human-dolphin communication experiments. And I'd already thought that if we can't communicate with dolphins, how would we ever communicate with our other neighbors out in interstellar space? So I read the book, and I read that he had invented something called the isolation tank. And when it was in the tank, he had his experiences as if he was talking with extraterrestrials. Well, I'm a scientist, and I was seriously interested in SETI. And I told my friend Bruce Bohannon about reading about this isolation tank, and he said, well, there's one down the street, two blocks away, and you can rent time in the isolation tank. So I did that, and to cut a long story short, I ended up buying an isolation tank and doing lots of experiments, which meant floating in the tank and having strange experiences, which I would then write about. But John Lilly said that before you float in the tank, you should set a goal. My goal was to learn as much as I could about extraterrestrial intelligence, which may seem a strange goal to you, but I still thought seriously about these things. And so I did have the same sorts of experiences as if extraterrestrials were communicating with me while I was in the tank, and dolphins as well. But I had some very scary experiences and other experiences which I write about in my book, which I don't want to talk about in public, because then you'll be certain that I'm crazy. But I was doing an experiment, and I was the experimentee. And just because something happened that frightened me or made me think I was crazy was no reason to stop the experiment, so I continued doing it. And to cut a long story short, because we don't have a lot of time, I ended up running a workshop at Esalen with John Lilly. So I went to Esalen. Before I went to Esalen, I had heard there was a woman here in town who did these trance medium sort of communications with extraterrestrials. And I went to one of those sessions, and I was allowed to ask questions. And so I said, are you talking with entities that are on another planet orbiting a star near the sun? And they said, yes. She said, yes. So I did a simple test. I said, well, do you know about astronomy? Yes. Well, tell me what's in interstellar space between your planet and ours. And I got a complete garbage answer, which obviously was an answer made by a human being who knew nothing about astronomy. So end of that experiment. But when I was in Esalen, they had somebody named Jenny, and she had Jenny and the Nine, and the Nine lived on a planet orbiting Sirius, and I went through the same thing and the same questions, and I got the same gibberish answer. So I was essentially, why was I in California? Well, I actually burned out on the planetarium job, so I quit, and I decided to just go through life and see where it led in this quest for extraterrestrials. And so Jenny and the Nine, I interviewed them, and that's all in my book. And again, I asked the same question, and I got the same sort of gibberish answer, because obviously the human beings I was talking to didn't know anything about anything. So again, to cut a long story short, after I quit the job here quit my tenured professorship, John Lilly invited me to work with him on human-dolphin communication. So I went to California and started working with John. We're trying to build an interface to talk with dolphins. And he introduced me to the people who were working at the Human Dolphin Foundation one day, and I thought nothing of that. And a few days later he said, well, Tony, which is his wife, and I are going away for the weekend. We'd like you to look after our house. And would I come and stay there? And he taught me how to operate the fire extinguishers and so on in Malibu. And so I did that. Then what happened? Now, John Lilly wrote about something called coincidence control. When you go on your life's journey and you start exploring esoteric things, very strange coincidences happen and makes you say, whoa, that was weird. Or, hey, I should pay attention to this. And I could give a whole talk about coincidences and synchronicities. But John Lilly was my coincidence guru. And ending up there was a series of coincidences. Anyway, I got in there that Friday afternoon, and just before they left, and he said, there's a phone message here for you. Oh, from who? One of the volunteers at the Human Dolphin Foundation. She wants you to phone her. I was single in these days, and I was having a weekend in John Lilly's house, and somebody in the Human Dolphin Foundation wanted to talk to me, and I figured this has got to be a dolphin groupie, and let's see what happens. Well, I phoned her, and she said, I'm supposed to meet you. Oh? All right, I'll meet you. Where? Tomorrow at the Malibu Nude Beach. This is all true. And I thought, whoa, this is going straight to the point. Well, we ended up at the Nude Beach, and we sat there. Oh, then the night before, I was sitting in front of John Lilly's television and all these books next to me. So I started looking at them, and one was called Strangers Among Us by Ruth Montgomery. And it was about a phenomenon which he called walk-ins, which is human beings who have been possessed by extraterrestrials. And I read the introduction, and then I looked at the rest of the book, and it was all elaborating with particular stories of this particular phenomenon. I'm in John Lilly's house now, and I read about walk-ins. Never heard about them before. So sitting on the nude beach with Suzanne, she asked me what I'm doing in California, and I explained that I've done the SETI experiment, and I'm now just going through life, seeing what I can learn about extraterrestrials by just following wherever the guides, the universe leads me. And she says, oh, now I understand why I'm supposed to talk to you. And I said, why? She says, because I'm an extraterrestrial. Now, if I had not been in Lily's house, and if I had not done my isolation tank experiments, I would have rejected her outright. And I said, but what are you doing here? What is this extraterrestrial? How did this happen? She said, I had a UFO encounter, and the extraterrestrial entered this body, and Suzanne no longer exists. I'm an extraterrestrial. What are you doing here? I'm here to help you communicate with dolphins. And how are you going to do that? Well, dolphins, it involves music. So, and I said, where are you from? And she said, I'm not from anywhere, I'm from another time. At that point, I should have rejected it as well. But I had a weird experience in the tank, thinking I was communicating with entities in another time. So, because of the coincidence of having seen that book at John Lilly's house and meeting this woman, I just had to take it seriously. So I spent 9 months of my time with her. I left working with John Lilly so I could find out what her story was about. And to cut a long story short, I finally figured it out. After spending a few weeks with her in Guatemala, I finally said, this is too much because, again, it's all in the book. So I came back to the United States, and I started thinking all this through and started writing down, because I've been writing all the time anyway, and tried to figure out what had happened to her and what had happened to me. She had done an experiment, which millions of people have done. And some people will think I'm now going to talk heresy, but millions of people have surrendered to Christ. She surrendered to the extraterrestrial with her entire being. Now, if you surrender to Christ and enter that path, you know what Christ is going to expect of you. It's already part of your culture. But if you surrender to the extraterrestrials, you have no idea what's going to happen, and she got lost. Her ego was essentially destroyed, and she wasn't completely insane, but she was functionally pretty useless. But this made me think about the nature of extraterrestrial intelligence, because I'm still fascinated by what's out there. And I'm going to give you my summary in a few sentences. I asked myself, what do we absolutely know about life on Earth? And my answer is, the only thing I'm absolutely certain of is evolution. Evolution occurs. So if there are other planets inhabited by intelligent entities, they would have experienced, it would be the result of evolution. And here in Boulder, I had talked to somebody named Ken Boulding, who was a professor here, and he told me the story about evolution, which stuck with me, and this made me come to this conclusion that I'm now going to give you. He said that one of his professors at Oxford, who was highly eccentric and would lecture from underneath a table, he made Kenneth write an essay about evolution. And when he read it and graded it, he said, but Boulding, what evolves? That's a good question. What evolves? So Ken Boulding says what evolves is information. And he's written a book called Ecodynamics, which elaborates on that. But I thought, maybe what evolves is consciousness. So I will hypothesize that consciousness is the phenomenon that truly evolves. In other words, we are more conscious than rats and mice and spiders and whatever. But if there are other planets with intelligent species on them, which I think is possible, I'm sure there's life everywhere, but there's no twin civilizations is my current thinking about this. Because if there are intelligent species that can develop technologies or do whatever that we could consider as conscious entities, they will have experienced evolution, and they will either be more evolved or less evolved than we are. And how do you communicate with a more evolved species, more conscious species, or with a less conscious species? And the answer is you can't. So that's where I am. If there are entities out there, this is the full circle coming from starting here in Boulder, and now this is the first time I've spoken about it publicly. If there are entities out there that are more conscious than we are, I doubt they'll be using technology. I cannot possibly figure out what they're doing. But is there any experiment I can do to become aware of their existence? And the answer is, there's only one experiment you can do. And that is you have to surrender to the possibility that it's possible. But I can do nothing active about this. The radio searches I regard as completely futile. So here I am. I went back into astronomy. I'm now publishing papers again. And if there are extraterrestrials who want to talk to me, or if a UFO wants to land in my garden, I'll go in and have a look and see what it's about. But I think that we are alone in the galaxy as far as our evolution is concerned, and we're not going to talk to anybody very soon. And that's, I think, is a quick summary of what's in this book.
Seth, can you top that?
Maybe I should answer no. That would simplify the discussion. This is a flat room, and I know the sight lines are terrible, so that's why I'm standing up. And as I often have said, it gives you the opportunity to throw things. Might be gratifying for you anyhow. I did want to address a few things that Gerrit said here, in particular the matter of people who claim that they are aliens or are in touch with aliens. As you know, you probably don't know, but when I first came to the Conference on World Affairs, I was totally ignored for quite a while until there was a session about UFOs, not UFOs. It was a session about extraterrestrial life. And the three of us on the panel, one was a young woman from NASA Goddard Research Center. The other was the wife of Rusty Schweikert, one of the Apollo astronauts. She was a futurist, and it was myself. And it was, you know, the session was going the way these sessions go, right? Until one elderly gentleman stood up in the middle of the room and said, I don't know why you're talking about these big antennas and how you're searching for extraterrestrial life, because I have been abducted by 6 different species. Whoa. Since the age of 5. And the moderator, who was a student, said, okay, thank you, sir, hoping that guy would sit down, which he did not. He said, I would like everybody else in the room who feels they've been abducted by aliens to stand up. And I thought, he's going to be a lone pole in the room, but that was not true. 8 other people stood up, and you know, and I started some sort of rebuttal. I said, look, the idea that the aliens would come hundreds of light years to Earth just to haul you out of your bedroom from unauthorized experiments, you know, that doesn't make any sense. And I didn't get any farther than that when some guy in the third row said, we're sick and tired of your jokes. We want respect, okay? And that's when somebody in the first row said, just sort of mumbled, Boulder meets the scientists. I honestly don't know what that means. I didn't know what it meant at the time. So, I don't want to get down this road too far, but I, you know, there were 3 women who were writing me regularly claiming they were aliens. So I've had that experience. I get phone calls every day about this sort of thing. But and one of them was, you know, kind of a nice correspondent. So I wrote back and I said, how do you know? And she said, my eyes. So I wrote back, do you have any photos of your eyes? And she said, well, yes. And she sent me 10 or 12 photos of her eyes. They were eyes. Okay. But let me get back to the subject. Honey, check out the new neighbors. Now, you know, we immediately jumped to extraterrestrial life, and I guess I'll come back to that because that's my day job. But it could be that the neighbors are actually literally neighbors, right? Because after all, the robots are coming. We all know that. There have been plenty of panels about that. And one of the first applications of robots is to help you with the housework. Everybody says, you know, that robot can't make the bed. It's of no use. It can't do the dusting. Well, those are coming, right? So the new neighbors might actually be living with you. Right, they're domesticated robots living with you, and you know, they have the opportunity to mow the lawn, something you probably don't care about. And you know, if you're a fan of Downton Abbey, right? One thing about Downton Abbey, I just really like the idea that there are a whole bunch of people downstairs who are going to take care of my next meal, you know, help me get dressed in the morning, stuff like that. I need a lot of help with that. Okay, so you know, they're not your new neighbors; they're your new kids, right? Without the expense of having to give them their own bedroom. So that's one way you might meet the neighbors. The new neighbors might, in fact, move in with you. Okay? And you might say, oh, well, that's kind of just science fiction, but it's not. Right? You already have these robots that are helping out in hospitals. You've seen them. You know, the machines walking the halls and stuff like that. Right? So that's coming, and that's coming, you know, maybe 10, 20 years, something like that. Certainly within your lifetime. Okay? So those are the new neighbors. Now, of course, the most obvious interpretation of this whole suggested title is that we're talking about extraterrestrial neighbors. They come in 2 flavors, right? First are the ones that you need a microscope to see, and those are the closest neighbors. All right, there are 7 other worlds. Those of you who've come to the science panels know this. There's 7 other worlds in our solar system that might have neighbors, right? Microbes. Okay. For example, Mars. It's everyone's favorite inhabited planet. But also there are 3 moons of Jupiter, right? A young man by the name of Leo here in the front row has volunteered to be on the first rocket to go to Europa and look around for aliens. Okay, they might be down in there. He thinks they're going to be little white worms. That could be. Could be useful for the fish industry. Okay, and then there are 2 moons of Saturn. There's going to be a big story tomorrow about one of the moons of Saturn and how there's some stuff being shot into space that's been checked out by the Cassini spacecraft that might indeed show evidence of biology under the icy carapace of Saturn's moon Enceladus. So watch out for that. Okay, so, and then there's, you know, David Grinspoon also at this conference has speculated on the possibility of microbial life living up in the upper atmosphere of Venus, where the temperatures are a little more salubrious than down on the surface, where it's 800 degrees. So those are 7 worlds that might be populated, neighbors. right? And you probably already regard your neighbors as scum. Well, these would be scum, okay? So I don't know if you need to check them out. You might want to turn them into Vegemite. I don't know. Okay. But let's consider the more intelligent variety of neighbors, ones that Harriet here has been talking about. I don't know that I need to say anything about UFOs. We can talk about that if you want. One third of the American public is convinced the aliens are here, buzzing the countryside and hauling you out of your bedroom. That would be interesting. I wish somebody would bring me a photo. But intelligent beings. The first thing you might ask is, well, I mean, how far away are these guys? Do we have any? Harriet says, no, not in our galaxy. Let me point out to you, there are a trillion planets in the galaxy. We know that now. We didn't know that 5 years ago, but we know that now. A trillion planets. Now, if you buy a trillion lottery tickets, they're not all losers. If you buy three, they're all losers. But if you buy a trillion, they're not. So a trillion planets, sure, most of those planets are worthless, like Neptune, you know, Uranus, they're not very interesting. But if you have a trillion of them, if you say, nope, there are a trillion planets, none of them has anything interesting enough to buy a condo in Loveland. That would make you a miracle. Garrett thinks you're a miracle. You probably think you're a miracle because your parents have been telling you that, right? But it may not be true. It makes us very special. And there's certainly a lot of historical precedent to suggest that whenever you think you're special, you're usually wrong. Okay, so let's say they are. But there is kind of a bottleneck. I mean, the idea that there's microbial life everywhere, that's not even considered controversial anymore, whereas 30 years ago it would have been. But it's not anymore. You know, grab the next 10 astronomers off the street, really a bad idea. But if you did that and say, hey, do you think there's life out there? I bet all 10 of them would say, sure, but it may only be microbial. And Harriet has volunteered that scenario in which you have maybe a lot of stupid life, you know, microbial life, but it never gets to the point of self-awareness, of consciousness. Right, we can have whole panels on consciousness, and could you ever build a machine that's self-aware and so forth and so on? This is not that panel, but we could. But the big stumbling block there is going from critters that are not aware to the critters that are aware. And if you just look back at the history of Earth, you can say, well, yeah, you start off with microbes, and pretty soon you get little tiny things that wiggle around under your microscope, and then you get, you know, trilobites, you get dinosaurs, and then you get us. You know, kind of a simplified version, but. And it sounds all so inevitable, but it's not inevitable, of course. That rock that took out the dino 66 million years ago, I remember it. When that came in, remember, if it had arrived 20 minutes earlier, you wouldn't be sitting here. There'd be dinosaurs in Boulder, okay? Many of you are thinking, yeah, there still are. Okay, so that's a big question. That's a big question. And you might think, no, but it's still inevitable, because the dinosaurs would have become smarter, and you'd still be here, you'd just be descendants of dinosaurs, like the chickens. You see how smart they are. Well, I asked a evolutionary biologist at the American Museum of Natural History a number of years ago, Niels Eldridge, and I said, so, you know, if the dinos hadn't been wiped out, would they have gotten smart? Would we, you know, have dinos in Boulder High, their descendants? And he said, well, the dinos had 150 million years to get smart and didn't. So what would another 66 million years have done for them? Okay, maybe that's true. But let me tell you what we're looking at now at the SETI Institute, you know, where I work. What we're aiming our antennas at these days tend to be red dwarf stars. And these are the little dim bulbs of the universe. They're three-quarters of all stars are these little dim bulbs. Some of you have heard about TRAPPIST-1. That's a dim bulb star. It's a red dwarf. It has seven interesting planets. There was a panel about that on Monday morning. Red dwarfs are known to have a lot of planets, and many of them are at the right distance from that star to possibly have liquid oceans and atmospheres and all the things that you need for biology if you're into biology. Okay, so we're looking at a whole bunch of those. You know, there are literally hundreds of billions of them in our galaxy, okay? So let's just skip forward, because I know this is getting tedious, soporific, and otherwise uninteresting. Let's skip forward and just assume that there is some cosmic company out there. How close are those neighbors? Well, it depends on how many are out there, right? Clearly, Carl Sagan thought there were maybe millions. That was his guess. It's called an estimate, but that's a euphemism for guess. All right. And so his estimate was a couple of million. If that's true, then the nearest neighbors are roughly 100 light years away, right? That's, you know, not so many. That's a half thousand trillion miles. And I don't know that you could go there, but you could exchange information. You could send radio messages back and forth. Hi, you want to join our book club? Whatever it is. All right. If Frank Drake, who kind of started the whole field of SETI, he figures there are like 10,000 of them out there. If that's the case, then the nearest other civilization is maybe a 500 to 1,000 light years away.
10,000 much bigger than
no, that. It's a two-dimensional system in the galaxy. It's simple.
No, most of it's uninhabited.
He disagrees. All right, we'll settle this later. If you think that the number is below 10,000, just take the square root of 10,000. It's 100. That's 1,000 light years. Okay. So if you figure they're fewer than that, if you figure they're only a couple of hundred or 10 or 1, right, then they could be essentially arbitrarily distant. They could be on the other side of the galaxy, and you're never going to, I wouldn't say never, but it's going to be very unlikely that you're ever going to get in touch. So that's my bottom line. I think there are some microbial neighbors that are fairly close to you. I think you're going to have neighbors in your own home pretty soon. And as far as intelligent life, I don't know that there'll ever be neighbors where you get to check them out and invite them to dinner, but at least you would know they were there.
All right.
Thank you. I should just say that Suzanne, my extraterrestrial, was celibate.
Okay. So this is session 3504. Honey, check out the new neighbors. Again, I want to remind you, please, to submit your questions via the app. And if you're not comfortable doing that, we have Bruce walking up and down the aisle with note cards if you'd like to fill those out. So the first question, and again, if this is yours, please do stand so that we can see you. Why should EM be the primary mode of communication for extraterrestrials?
I'd like to touch on that because it concerns dolphins. We are not aware of any other mode, but when I was involved with the dolphin community, they all believed they were working there because the dolphins had told them through telepathy.
Neutrino, don't go that way.
No, this is the way you can go. And lots of people think that this is true. But we are not aware of any other way of communicating.
Gravitational waves.
Oh, sure, which have a wavelength of light years and frequencies of... No. So, no, electromagnetic waves is what we are, the environment in which we live, and I say the answer is no.
It's the only one that we have maximum knowledge of.
That's right.
All right, before this gets into a fist fight, I don't know that anybody can actually hear the gentleman who penned the question. And he's saying neutrinos and gravity waves. Garrett is saying telepathy. Telepathy would be great. I was on a panel with Lilly many years ago, and that's what he was saying as well, that it was telepathy. The trouble is I think that there's an experiment, ongoing experiment, that shows that telepathy doesn't work. And that experiment is called Las Vegas. Okay, so... But I also have to say that that neutrinos, that's very frequently suggested. Everybody know what a neutrino is? Anybody interested in neutrinos? Anybody studying neutrinos? Okay, neutrinos are, you know, these little particles that, you know, 10 zillion of them gone through your body while you've sat through this soporific presentation. But they're very hard to detect. They're, you know, it takes a kilometer worth of ice down in the Antarctic to pick up a couple of neutrinos every day and that kind of thing. There are a lot of them. And the trouble with neutrinos, just from my point of view, is that they're very expensive to produce, take a lot of energy per bit. So, you know, and they don't go any faster than the speed of light, right? They don't. They go slower than the speed of light. So I don't get the advantage. Gravity waves do have an advantage if you're into gravity waves. And by the way, they're not light years in wavelength. Otherwise, you wouldn't have picked them up with LIGO. But gravity waves, the problem with gravity waves is if you want to make gravity waves, you got to do something like shake a star. I mean, Garrett's right about that. That's really tough. That's really tough. And, you know, you get a couple of bits, you shake a star, boo. You know, don't you want to send the internet or something to somebody? I mean, using gravity waves, I think, it's hard. And the one advantage of gravity waves is that you don't have to aim an antenna anywhere. They're coming right through the Earth, right? So you'll pick them up no matter where they're coming from, and that's maybe an advantage.
If we do find microbial life on another planet, how would we study it without the risk of contaminating Earth or the origin planet of the microbe?
You would study it in situ, out there. Clever spacecraft would have all sorts of wonderful detection devices, and you would study them at distance. You don't bring them back to the Earth. You don't have to do that.
Well, that is one way to do it. However, as some of you know, NASA has an Office of Planetary Protection, and their bumper sticker says, all the planets, all the time. And it's a very small group. I mean, there may be two or three people. Cassie Conway is the head of that. And she will point out that they have been 100% successful It's right. It's like the local, my neighborhood association protecting the neighborhood against rampaging elephants. They've been completely successful. Okay. So, but the thing about planetary protection, there's this forward contamination, which Garrett points out. If you do the experiment on Mars, you don't have to worry about bringing Martians back that might, you know, infect everybody. I think there's a biological argument against that biological infection coming back from anywhere, but you can't assume that. The risks are too great. So what happens is if you bring anything back, and there are plans for sample return missions to Mars, at least, you really do want to bring something back. If you do that, you, of course, keep it boxed up as much as you can.
Okay. How close is the Allen Telescope Array from adding more telescopes to the ones already constructed?
The Allen Telescope Array is what we use at the SETI Institute to scan the skies. If anybody deigns to go to California, it's about 300 miles north of San Francisco, and you can go visit it. It's during the week. You can just walk in. And it only has 42 antennas. The design goal was 350. And if there's somebody in the audience who has done very well in their investments and would like to buy more antennas, that's great. There's no government money for it, you understand. All SETI in this country is funded by donations. So that's why we don't build more antennas.
Okay. We have a question for Garrett. Did Susan pass the astronomy test? Or the look test to got you to spend 9 months in South America? I'm not sure how to read that.
No, she didn't pass the astronomy test. The interaction was too fascinating and didn't have to get into astronomy. I said, how does the extraterrestrial help us humans communicate with dolphins? And if you're a psychology major, you will know this is an interesting answer. She said, I'm act as your mirror. And that is something that gurus do in India. They act as your mirror, and so I spent my time, every time I had an argument with her, she would be a mirror and I wouldn't get anywhere. It gets very complicated and very, very, it really does things to your head. I like to think that I emerged from this type of experiment fairly sane. And this is actually the danger of doing this type of experiment. She floated in an isolation tank and did acid before she did that, and she never got out of the trip, I don't think. But when you do these experiments, it really helps to be a scientist. There's some books that have been written about this, one called Cosmic Trigger by Robert Anton Wilson, because when you start experimenting with your consciousness or your mind, you can get into very scary places, and it can become very dangerous. So if you're a scientist, you are trained to look at the problem, your experience or experiment from the outside. And I was able to step in and out. And that is in itself something that you don't want to get into without somebody guiding you.
Okay, thanks. Question from the audience. What, in your opinion, is the most realistic depiction of aliens or extraterrestrials in science fiction?
Well, how do you know? Who asked that question? Are they going to stand up? Are you going to own up to that question?
Come on.
Jeepers creepers. I mean, you know, you'll only be garroted for it. All right. Nobody wants it. Obviously, we don't know the answer to that. And of course, if you watch TV and movies, it's a little gray guy with big eyeballs and, you know, small noses, small mouths. Because, you know, we're losing our olfactory sense. We're losing our dentition. So this is just a projection of what's going to happen to us. Yeah. We're going to look like those little gray guys in a million years or something. I don't know that that's true, but that's the underlying idea. I've consulted for a lot of, you know, cheesy sci-fi films, and they always ask me, what will the aliens look like? And you can volunteer anything you want. I mean, I usually tell them, just go to the local zoo. Everything in that zoo, at least 85% of their DNA is identical to yours, but they don't look like you. I hope not. I mean, if you go to the primate house, they look a little bit like you, but most of the rest are fish, snakes, giraffes, whatever. They don't look like you. So why would the aliens look anything like us? But that doesn't carry very much currency for the filmmakers, because having the aliens be these little gray guys is a storytelling shortcut, obviously. You don't need any backstory there. You don't need to waste screen time explaining this thing that looks like a bicycle is actually an alien, right? So, you know, from their point of view, it's handy to have it's like the black hats in the old, you know, cowboy and western films. It's a shortcut.
I recommend a new science fiction movie highly, which I saw on the plane coming here, Arrival. It's fantastic. And that alien didn't look like humans at all. Seven legs or six legs? How many?
Seven.
Seven?
Heptapods.
Yeah, I think it's the most realistic science fiction film I've seen. It's really fantastic.
The Japanese have recognized that those aliens would make great sushi. You can get 2,000, I've worked this out, you can get 2,000 servings of sushi from every alien. So you just farm them.
Which is why the aliens would never make contact with us, because we'd have this sort of reaction.
So a follow-up question to that. How does the idea of extraterrestrial life make you feel? Terrified? Insignificant? Excited? Or in Seth's case, hungry?
That's a very good question. I would like nothing more than to learn truly what life is like on another planet. In other words, flying there and landing and seeing it. But I'm just stuck with the fact that I don't know, and I doubt that we will ever know for the next few hundred years.
That's a real inducement for me to go to work on Monday, I got to say. I don't think about that too much. People ask, why is anybody doing this work, right?
Yes.
And very often people say, look, we've got all these problems on Earth. You come to Boulder, and people are interested in climate change. They're interested in immediate problems that affect them or, Golden or someplace. And they say, and this is just a waste of money. Well, to begin with, of course, it's not taxpayer money, so you can rest easy in that regard. But it's curiosity, and I've pointed out before, curiosity is not a frivolous talent or idea or activity. Curiosity is what distinguishes societies that move forward from those that don't. The classical Egyptian civilization didn't have much in the way of curiosity, and they were taken over by the Greeks and then the Romans. So curiosity is really important, but it's also very interesting, right? It's like, why would you fund this guy, Wolfie Mozart? And we got people dying in the streets of, Vienna. Why don't, music, that's such a waste. We got to do something good for humanity. But I don't think anybody in this room would doubt that that was a good investment. And I think it's the same for just understanding the universe. But more than that, finding out, is this the only game in town? Are you it? Are you the most intelligent beings in the galaxy? Right? I know you like to think that. It's very satisfying somehow. But on the other hand, it might be interesting to find out it's not true.
Well, Seth just set me up for something I want to mention here. Why do you want to do this experiment? And the answer I'm going to give you came from Jill Tarter in the days before the VLA was built. It came from Frank Drake at an IAU meeting, and it came from Thomas McDonough's book about SETI. He worked at the SETI Institute. And the reason they gave is totally preposterous. They are going to tell us things we need to know in order to survive as a species. They will give us the secrets to curing cancer. These have actually been said in public by SETI people and has been in the SETI book. And the funny thing is, when I asked the dolphin people, why are you wanting to communicate with dolphins? They gave me exactly the same answer. And I just got blown away by that. It's an expression of, and I wrote a little article in Sky and Telescope, said, if we are alone, what on earth are we doing? The need to have some other force greater than ourselves, knowing more than us and helping us survive, is deep in the human consciousness, which is why we have religions. And the SETI and that article I said was like a technological religion, looking for answers from out there, whereas the answers are right in front of us because we have the answers to our own problem if we would ever stop to pay attention to them. We've had very wise people on the earth giving answers to some of these questions, and they've been ignored, or like Christ, for example. So I find this an extraordinary motive that other people have put forward for the search. Seth makes it sound more idealistic, but this stuff I'm talking about now, I've seen in writing, and I've heard these Jill Tarter and Frank Drake say this in public.
All right. Harry is trying to make this interesting by throwing these challenges out to me, so I'll take him up on that. I don't know that any of my colleagues have said that, but they may very well have said that. Yes. It's going to give us the cure for death, or how to avoid war, how to get along, and all that. I don't buy that either. I'm with you, Garrett. I don't think that's going to happen. To begin with, you're not going to understand them, right? If we send a television signal back to the Neanderthals somehow, right? Hi, Neanderthals. Look, here's some elementary physics, and here's enough electronics that you can build, cell phones or something. It just doesn't matter. They're not going to understand any of it. So the idea that some advanced society, and it has to be more advanced than we are, for them to be broadcasting something our way, that they're going to teach us something that's, you know, useful to us, I'm with you. I don't think that'll happen. But what they do say, this I know, they may have said all that too, but what they do say is this, and I disagree with it too, by the way, that if you find another example of an intelligent society, and one that, by definition, by the very fact that you found them, means that they're more advanced, then at least that tells you that they have survived their own troubles like, you know, climate change, nuclear war, all the things that we go through once you get to a certain technological level. That there's an example proof that you can make it, right? It's like seeing old people. Now you know you can survive being a teenager. Okay. The trouble with it is, this is, you know, that sounds pretty good too, but I don't buy that either. I'm with Garrett on this thing. That, you know, yeah, maybe this particular one you found did, but there were 10,000 others that, you know, imploded. So yes. It may be just a selection effect. Yeah.
So we've had several questions on the James Webb Space Telescope, which, if for those of you who aren't familiar with it, this is going to be the next major observatory in space that's going to launch in 2018. Ball Aerospace was very privileged to have played a role in terms of developing, designing, and building the advanced optical system that's going to allow the telescope to look back in time 13 billion years. And again, this is going to be like Hubble on steroids. We're very excited about it. One of the questions that we've received, actually several questions along the same lines, is will the James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST, be able to tell us about the possibility of extraterrestrial life?
I don't know.
Probably not.
Yeah.
With all deference to Ball Aerospace, because it is a very interesting telescope. And it's supposed to launch, what, in the fall of 2018? Did I get that, Roger? Okay, so, yeah, it's an infrared telescope, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Mostly that have to do with cosmology, you know, studying the early universe, because everything's moving away from us, so all the light is shifted to the infrared and all that. But it also has the ability, in principle, to look at the light coming off a planet around another star, right? And analyzing that light and seeing if there's methane or oxygen in the atmosphere, right? If you found oxygen in the atmosphere, you could say, gosh, you know, there's cabbage in space. Or if there's methane, you know, there are pigs in space, right? So, but the problem is you've got to actually get a little bit of light from that planet. And as you probably know, there have been 3,000 or 4,000 planets found around other stars. That number isn't so interesting. What's interesting is that the fraction of stars that has planets is almost one. It's 70%, 80%, something like that, at least. Okay, but though almost all of those planets, with the exception of two or three, were found via indirect means, not by looking through a telescope and seeing the planet, but looking through the telescope and seeing that a star is dancing around or that a planet gets in front of a star and dims the light a little bit. That's the way they've been found. And that's not good enough to tell you, gosh, does it have an atmosphere? Is there water vapor in the atmosphere? Is there methane in the atmosphere? Is there oxygen in the atmosphere? Could James Webb do that? In a few cases, if you have, you know, really a good set of you know, nearby planets where there's enough light bouncing off the planet they can see it. TRAPPIST-1 is the one that everybody's asking about now. Could it tell you anything about the TRAPPIST-1 system? And the answer to that is maybe. It's right on the edge of what you can do. I think one thing you can count on is the fact, A, it will be tried, and B, there are a number of telescopes being built today that are in what are called the 30-meter class. Right? When I was a kid, you know, just as the Spanish-American War was getting underway, when I was a kid, the biggest telescope was the 200-inch at Mount Palomar, which is 5 meters. These are telescopes that are 30 meters across. So that's 36 times more collecting area. And they may be able to do it.
Yeah, and on another day here, there's a Astronomy's New Toys panel. And the point I'm going to try and make there, and I'll make it here right now, is that these great big new telescopes, including the James Webb, have one inevitable consequence, and they drain the funds out of a lot of astronomy. And this is of great concern to astronomers. Something to say, it's a great technological project, but it's hard to keep funding these big projects unless we have a new government.
So just a time check, we've got 5 more minutes, so I'm going to ask our two panelists to whip through these next few questions. There are a huge number of neurologists who are presently experimenting with the brain in order to understand consciousness. Is this dangerous?
No. The more we know about consciousness, the better. But it's a fascinating question. I am not going to say more about that because it is too fascinating a question. It would take another few panels to deal with what's consciousness and how do we test it and how do we know when we're conscious and blah, blah, blah.
Thank you for the question.
Yep. Okay.
If you get through some questions.
Sure. In your opinion, was the 1947 crash in Roswell, New Mexico, a true encounter with aliens, or just an accident misunderstood and blown out of proportion?
There was a government project called Project Mogul, which fully accounts for what happened in Roswell. It didn't involve aliens. It did involve government people, which might be the same, actually. But it was part of an experiment. Project Mogul was part of an experiment to try and determine whether the Soviet Union had nuclear weaponry. That's what it was. And it explains everything that happened in Roswell. But if you're a true believer, you see, if you really think that the aliens came hundreds of light years to visit New Mexico,
yes.
I always figure it's the Tex-Mex cuisine. I don't know. But, you know, they come all this way, and then the last 50 feet, they make a navigation error and crash into the dirt, which I point out to you is fully equivalent to you driving to New York and then totaling your car on the garage door. If you think that's fine, but, you know, where's the evidence? It's been 60 years, and maybe you think, because the trouble is you have to make it what's called an argument from ignorance. I know it's true, but the government has kept all the information from me. Right. You know, I've worked for the government, even our government. I've worked for the government, and the idea that they could keep this secret for 60 years truly stuns me.
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, you can believe it if you want, but we've learned nothing from it, have we?
That's right. Nothing more to say on that one.
Okay. What is your opinion on the Fermi paradox?
They're not out there. The Fermi paradox is, where is everybody? If there's life elsewhere, why haven't we seen it yet? And I think the answer is, if you take it seriously, that we haven't seen radio signals from all sorts of civilizations, because there aren't all sorts of civilizations out there. I'd be the first one to be excited if somebody discovered a signal from extraterrestrials, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay. Well, he may be right. I mean, that's one explanation for the Fermi paradox. We haven't heard from anybody because there's nobody to hear from. But there's another thing you should think about. The number of star systems that have been examined carefully for signals, for example, radio signals, that's what we do, but is, you know, a few thousand. Now, in a galaxy of a couple of hundred billion stars, that means like, you get a grant to go to Africa to see if there are any big mammals with long noses that eat peanuts. And you look at one city block of Africa and you say, you know, didn't see any. And you could conclude that there are none there, or you could say, we didn't look at enough of Africa, so there's your choice.
Okay. And our last question. Can you speak to the Canadian government's exopolitical policy? I heard it was prompted by an admiral's experience in seeing a UFO.
Yeah, is this a former defense minister? Whoever asked the question, maybe they could clarify that. That guy who has testified that he's seen UFOs? Nobody wants to own up. I have seen this guy's testimony, and you know, I've heard testimony from people like Edgar Mitchell, who's a U.S. astronaut, and many, many others. Who claim that they have good evidence of UFOs. Look, you know, it's not impossible that somebody has come here just to, you know, buzz the skies, but if the evidence were good, you would have a lot of people working on it, and you could go to the Smithsonian and see an exhibit on it, and you can't. And if you argue that that's because the government is covering it up because you couldn't handle the news, this is an insult to your intelligence, of course, that you couldn't handle the news, you can believe that too, but again, that's an argument from ignorance. It's saying, I can't prove it to you because they're hiding the evidence, and that's a very poor logic.
I have no comment on that.
I actually saw a UFO and it lasted about a minute. It was a thing sticking at the end of an airplane wing. I didn't know what it was. It was a little vertical line, dark. It was unidentified. I didn't know what it was. It was flying. It was on the engine of the airplane. So it was a UFO. And then the plane slowed down and the thing went unstable and disappeared. It was a pressure wave that had produced a funny refraction, and that was my UFO experience. And the UFO fans don't like it when I tell them that, but it was flying and I was unidentified for about a minute.
All right. Please join me in thanking our two distinguished panelists.